Good to see all of you here. Welcome to our service this morning. I want you to do me a favor, if you could, wherever you are, turn to people on your left and right, and just thank them for attending service today. Just thank them. It's so good to see you here. Say that to them. That should be actually a heartfelt thing from week to week, but especially so during a long weekend. So you are the faithful ones, because in every long weekend I hear from fellow pastors all around Singapore, 10 to 20% of the congregation goes to Malaysia or disappear to Batam and Bintan. Nothing wrong with that. Good time for us to unwind and to recharge as God's people. Best way to be following the message, page 3, just outlined there. And just under point 1, I'm going to make 2 points, God's heart to us. A, God and Kings. B, God and Solomon. A is God and Kings. B is God and Solomon. How many of us watched the royal wedding? No shyness here. I watch it, some bits of it, in between Bible study, sermons, ministering to people, etc. Where are they now? Where are they now? Have they walked down? Have they taken the vows? Is it finished? How many watched the royal wedding? Good. How was it? Did it live up to the standard or measure of royal weddings? Weddings fit for kings and queens. Let's go for the bridal car. It was a Rolls Royce, you know. But the thing you got to ask is, which model of the Rolls? And for us, the common layman, you mean there are different models of Rolls Royce? Yes, of course. Theirs had all glass at the back. What a class, right? What a class all by itself. Did you notice that? And it's almost full-length height. When you get up, you just stoop a little bit just ahead. You don't go right down. For most of us, our car will come out like that, right? I mean, what a car. And the cake, did it match Queen Elizabeth's wedding? 9 feet high, 120 pounds of sugar. Queen Elizabeth's cake. And that dress. That dress. Did the simple lines of that Sarah Burton design, I do read the papers. Did the simple lines of that Sarah Burton design meet the mark of royal weddings, of brides? They've taken place 1,000 years in Westminster Abbey. It was simple, but was it stunning? And finally, the wave. Was the wave within the permissible angle? Because most of us common folk, when we meet each other, hello! That's so uncultured, you know. It's just so unrefined. But we royals, it must be. And the conclusion, I was listening to the royal experts, the royal biographers, the royal commentators, all on television, in one English word, with, of course, the British accent, splendid. All things to do with kings and monarchs, once-off weddings, ongoing rule, rightly have a standard, a measure, an assessment, a criteria. And it's not just any standard, but it has to be a high standard. Rightly so, understandably so, because it is of no less than kings, of royals, of monarchs, those who rule on God's behalf. Once you follow that track, friends, it's quite easy to understand 1 and 2 Kings. One simple way to understand 1 and 2 Kings is that it's all about the measure, the assessment, the criteria, the standard of kings. And we usually measure the kings of old and governments of today, modern governments of today, by 4 main measures. We usually measure them according to their political, military, economic, and social achievements. Political stability, military security, economic prosperity, and social peace. The measure of Israel's kings would be different. Different would be too light a word. The measure of Israel's king would be distinctive. Distinctive is even not, it would be unique. Unique means one and only. There is no other measure. the measure of Israel's king under God, they will not be measured politically, militarily, economically, or socially. They will be measured spiritually. No other government of the world measures its government spiritually. God would use a spiritual barometer. In technical or theological terms, Israel's kings will be measured by covenant fidelity or infidelity, covenant faithfulness or unfaithfulness. In simpler terms, Israel's kings will be measured by how they kept or broke the covenant or contract with God that God had made only with them. In simplest terms, Israel's kings will be measured whether they were faithful or unfaithful to God. In one word, the measure of Israel's king was God. Have you gotten it? It's as simple as that. No other government of the world is measured by God. Not in their conscious mind, assessment or criteria. It's always measured by the people. By the people's needs, by the cost of living, by education, by hospitals. But God's measure of his kings was totally unique. So here, in the opening chapters of 1 Kings to chapter 12, 1 Kings 1 to 12, it is a transition between the second king and the third king. The first king was Saul. The second king is David. It was the last days of David and the early days of King Solomon. And that transition was not altogether like a baton pass in a relay race. It was shaky. They didn't know whether it was going to be a smooth transition, and the early chapters carry the political maneuverings and intrigue that almost cut out Solomon from his rightful kingship under God. Then these two books, 1 and 2 Kings, which must be read together, we must read them and understand that they stretch over 400 years from David's last days in 907 BC to perhaps the exile, the time of exile, where they were reading this. It was written for them about 550, 540 BC. So about 400 years. And it was written 1 and 2 Kings for a set purpose. It was written to explain to them. It was written to explain the people in exile. You know what happened to you? In exile, that means you're being punished by God. So what happened to you? People of God, punished by God. People of God, punished by God. Totally contradictory, as it were. And now you sit in exile. You know what happened to you while you sit in exile? Because you chose your kings and assessed your kings on the wrong basis. You chose your kings using the wrong measures. And where on earth did that wrong measure start? It started with the first king, Saul. You chose him because he was a whole head taller than the rest. He had a body that was incomparable to the rest. You chose your kings like any other nation. You chose them based on externalities. But I, God, Yahweh, have told you that I will choose my kings. God's assessment of his king and the people under that king will come down to one criteria, one word: heart. Heart. I was reading this in preparing for 1 Kings while I was on a mission trip to Thailand. And away from family, away from wife, after I came back from the talks at night, I sat and read this book through 2 or 3 times. I couldn't help being struck. I didn't bring my computer, there's no way to Google this. I couldn't help being struck by the number of times heart appears. Right? I didn't count, but it just bang, just hit me. Right? So when you read God's word aloud, it hits you, it hits you, it hits you, it hits you. And finally Googled this, it appears 25 times in 1 Kings itself. Heart. Half of those times, 12 times, heart appears between chapters 8 and 9. What's chapter 8 and 9? Chapter 8 and 9 is Solomon's prayer to God. And in Solomon's prayer to God, it's all about his heart and the people's heart. His heart and the people's heart. That's what God is going for. And then 5 times heart is used in this chapter, in chapter 11. And so one word to understand God's assessment of kings is actually what on earth is going on in your heart. David, Solomon. So once we understand the backdrop, we can now plunge in God's heart to us. And the link here is chapter 10, verse 24. The first slide comes on. 10:24. 1 Kings 10:24. Is that it? If not, I'll just read it. Yep. The whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put where? Not in his mind, not in his brain, but in his heart. And just in case we get on the wrong track, in the Old Testament, the Bible's usage of heart is the head is in the heart. And we moderns, we think the heart is a place of emotion, of passion. See, I say, I'm so torn, you know, I've got two guys to choose from. My head says choose Robert. My heart says choose Roberto. And so there's a dichotomy in there. The Bible didn't think that way. Your heart is a seat of the will. The heart is in the head, is in the heart. The whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put into his heart. And this is a recognition of one. Chapter 10, verse 1. When the queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and his relation to the name of the Lord. Lord means Yahweh, L-O-R-D, capital Yahweh, Y-A-H-W-E-H. She came to test him with hard questions. And so the only reason Solomon had fame to wisdom, justice, righteousness, and wise rule, distinctively wise beyond others, was that he was related to Yahweh. That mustn't be lost on us. So the long and short, all that is happening to Solomon is because of God's good-heartedness towards him. For he would not be a standalone. All that's happening to him is because God had downloaded wisdom into his heart. That's the thing to note. So what was distinctive about Solomon vis-a-vis the other kings and queens? Verse 2, chapter 10, verse 2. Arriving at Jerusalem with a great caravan, with camels carrying spices, large quantities of gold, precious stones, she came to Solomon, talked with him about all that she had on her mind. Has a woman ever talked to you about all that she has on her mind? It's a lot, you know. All that, sometimes Mona said, there's a lot on my mind, Mona. Are you, there's all that she had on her mind. So Solomon answered, the big word here is all. Look at verse 3. So Solomon answered all her questions. Not some of her questions, not most of her questions, but all of her questions. Nothing was too hard for the king to explain to her. When the queen of Sheba saw all the wisdom of Solomon, the palace he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his officials, attending with servants of their robes, in their robes, his cupbearers, and burnt offerings he made at the temple of the Lord, she was. And so, Queen Sheba came, and what did she do? Queen Sheba came, and she did a one-to-one quiz show with Solomon. She did a who wants to be a millionaire with him. Just threw him hard question after hard question after hard question, perhaps that none of her wise men could answer. And Solomon answered all of them, and her response was, she was overwhelmed. Overwhelmed. She was bowled over. And so Solomon's reputation for wisdom, for justice, for righteousness, for distinctiveness, was already preceded him. Sometimes people meet you and say, your reputation precedes you. Hopefully it's a good reputation, huh? Your reputation precedes you. And here's where, you know, sometimes you... How many of you like watching concerts? When you watch concerts at the Esplanade or the indoor stadium, sometimes you come back from the concert and say, you tell your friends, don't bother buying the ticket. You know why? The CD was much better. Because live, she's always out of tune. Shows how much they mix it all up for her, right? She actually has a lousy voice. This group actually sounds off, you know. But when you listen to the CD, it sounds so good. That means the live version is worse than... But with Solomon, the reputation is good, and when you meet the person live, he's even better. And you would do the reverse. When you meet Solomon, say, don't bother buying the CD. Go and watch him live. When you watch him live, it is so... One word, so unreal. We have never met a man like that. Never heard such wisdom. Never. Why? Why? He's just a class by himself. Because this is a glimpse, a temporary glimpse of a temporary king, of a temporary kingdom living in a temporary land under God. And God had told them this. He began the promises with Abraham, then carried it on with Moses, then carried on with David. When you live my way, you will be a distinctive nation among all the other nations. And so when king and people live under God, it can be that good. There is no one, this is the king wisdom par excellence, no comparison. So this description of Solomon in 1 Kings 9:10, it's not an exaggeration. It's not. And so here, it is that good living under God. I've told you this story in different ways. My father was the richest man in town, or so they told me, because by the time I was born, he was perhaps the poorest man in town. He had gone from richest to poverty. At the height of his riches, he was the only one in town who could afford to buy a Model T car. Ford Model T car. When it was released, the first one. When my second brother was born, 10 years older than me, he invited the entire town and threw a banquet for the whole town. I think 1,000 people came. When they found out, my mother found out that she was carrying me, the first thought was to abort me. Big difference, right? One child, you invite the whole town, the next child, your fortunes had turned. And they kept the photos of the glory days of my father. Now, one of those pictures is the coronation of Queen Elizabeth. Imagine that. And because we were still under the British Empire, they had a competition in our town. All the shop houses, they decorated them as best as they could. We won prize number 2. I still have that photo. This year, my mother turns 100. And if you are a subject of the British Empire, you can write to the Queen and she will send you a commendation. Do you know that? So it's inspiration for you to live to 100. Life is that good. Life is that good. It was just wonderful. But I never experienced it. Doesn't mean if I didn't experience it, it's not true. It seems totally unreal, the description, but it was totally real. This is no exaggeration. When king and people live under God, they are wise beyond measure. And God told them, if you live this way according to the Deuteronomy promises, I will bless you materially. They were rich beyond measure. And when you enter the promised land, he will give them rest. They were secure beyond measure. Life can be that good when king and people live under God. But here is, I both love and hate watching love stories, romantic movies, especially Hindi movies. But I've learned to watch them because my wife loves them. And if I don't watch Hindi movies, there goes half our life. The first part of most Hindi movies is good. Handsome guy meets beautiful girl. Handsome guy meets beautiful girl. And then they sing, sing, sing. They dance, dance, dance. From the mountains of Nepal to the valleys of New Zealand. All in one song. Have you ever noticed that? It's just amazing. The scenery is just bewildering. Right? It's just so good, so good. Then you see something in your heart. It's the first time watching it, I warn you, right? It's so good, so good. Actually, you should move it. And it's too good to be true. It's too good to last. Because soon will come the wicked mother. You knew she was always lurking in the background. Soon will appear the crooked uncle. Soon will come that nasty competitor. When you read 1 Kings 10, it is the charmed life living under God. When king and people live under God, it can be that good, they can be that wise, they can be that rich, they can be that secure. And here comes the turning point, chapter 11. King Solomon, however, the moment we read however, here is the Hindi movie, Korean soap opera moment. It is going downhill from this point onwards. Right? Too good to last. It was good. It was really good. And the problem here was, King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women. Solomon's problem was not simply that he loved women. Solomon's problem, like Samson's problem during the period of Judges, was that he loved foreign women. And if you listen to this as modern-day people in some circles, isn't that a racist statement? Just marrying your own tribe, your own circle, your own race. Mustn't understand it racially. must always understand it spiritually. Why? What's so wrong about that? They have been told about this. Exodus 34. Obey what I command of you today. I will drive up before you the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Be careful not to make a treaty with those who live in the land. These are all the foreign nations. Don't make a treaty with them politically, militarily, economically. Where you are going, or they will be a snare to you. They will stumble you. In what way? Next slide. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, cut down their Asherah poles. Do not worship any other god. For the Lord Yahweh, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. The point here is this. Is there a Deuteronomy 6 passage after this? No. God had warned them. They had been told. Very important background. And this is not to be understood just racially or humanly. This is to be understood spiritually. Example. Let's say my son he comes back one night. And as he walks in, I'm sitting on the sofa at the dining table having my cup of coffee. As my son walks in, after he greets me, "Hello, Dad," I just get up and slap him. What do you call me as a father then? Fickle, temperamental, no warning, no reason, I just disciplined him. This is not what happened to them. This is not what happened to Solomon. It's not as if God was just smacking him. God had warned him, don't do this. Don't marry foreign wives. Because foreign wives will lead you to the worship of foreign gods. And that will be the beginning of the end of you. In that sense, God is totally unique. What? Why? Every and all Canaanite gods never make this claim. What claim? Every and all Canaanite gods never make this claim that you are mine alone. They do not make an exclusive claim on their worshippers. There's no exclusive devotion. There's no exclusive worship. All our human gods have no problem with what? All our human gods have no problem with sharing us with others. Pluralism is the word. And hence, relativism. All our human gods have no problem doing that. So I've told this about a New York couple. New York couple, New York. Number one city, cosmopolitan city of the world. And so they got married, but they had a very modern or postmodern approach to marriage. Anytime you meet someone whom you're attracted to, by all means go out and date them, etc. They were going through a rough patch. The husband came back early one morning after a long night at work, a hard night at work. He walked in and he called his wife out with another man. Both of them grabbed the sheets, wrapped themselves with that sheet. And the guy who was caught said to the husband as he walked into the door, "I hope you don't mind me staying over. This is New York, you know." The husband's reply is, "No, it's all right. I don't mind you staying over. I don't mind you drinking my coffee. I don't mind you sitting on my sofa. I don't mind you sleeping with my wife." Then he walks up to the television set and smashes the television set and says, "But I do mind you watching my television set." No matter how modern or postmodern we are, friends, that's not the way we are made. We are not made to give our hearts to many. We are not made to share our beds with others beyond our God-given spouses. Why? Because that's our God-given nature. Because that is God's nature. God is a covenant God. Big technical word today. Covenant God means He's a God of dependable love. He's a God of reliable love. He's a God, in Singlish, steady love. His love is a steady love. You can always depend on His love. And His love is a jealous love. It's exclusive and mutually exclusive of all else. God is rightly jealous of who belongs to Him and what rightly belongs to Him. Israel belongs to Him. And so, friends, we got to understand this. This is totally distinct and unique. To understand the background of Exodus 30, the warnings not to take foreign wives, this is the God of covenant love. I was very late to pick up my son from primary one, early days of primary one. How late? It was very late, half an hour, 45 minutes, I forget. By the time I arrived at the car park in the school, parked there, raced, I could see the last teacher who was accompanying him all the time, waiting with him, was walking away from him. So I ran up to my son, right, and I could see that he was tearing up. Not sobbing yet, but tearing up. I got to him, I reached down low to where he was. Shun, sorry, sorry, Daddy got caught up. And I forget, it was a meeting, a counseling case. No handphones at that time, nothing I could do to contact him. And he said something along these lines. It's okay, Dad. I always knew you would come. I always knew you would come. That is a statement of covenant love. I always knew you would be for me, not against me. I could always depend on your reliable love. Your love is a steadfast love. For a young child, that is usually their understanding of their human parents. Once you grasp that, friends, then you understand not that this is not a racial statement, this is not a discrimination statement, this is a spiritual statement. From the Old Testament to the New Testament, God has never been a pluralistic God. He is not a God who makes us and then shares us. He's not such a God. For Israel, he had not just made them, but he mercifully chose them and then redeemed them from years of slavery to Pharaoh. And so, Yahweh rightly desired and demanded total exclusive worship and love. With God, friends, please take note, it is all or nothing, like a switch, right? It's either on or off. If you put the switch to neutral, you will electrocute. You will cause a short circuit in that relationship. Great harm. Here is the jealous God, his jealous love over who and what is rightly his. I say again, the gods of our world have no problem sharing us with others. The gods of this world who have no problem sharing us with others are no gods at all. And the forerunners of this were the Ashtaroth of the Sidonians, Molech of the Ammonites, Chemosh of the Moabites. They are what they are. Idols made by our human imagination and our human hands. To do what? Gods who allow you to share you with whatever. Right? So you can do materialism, you can do what? Pluralism, you can do atheism, whatever it is, friends. The gods that we manufacture by human imagination and hands, we create to justify our unfaithfulness to God and our faithfulness to neighbor, to rationalize our fickle affections for God and our fickle affections for husband, wife, parent, child, and brother and sister. The true God of the universe does not make us, redeem us, only to share us. He is, rightly so, a jealous God. Amen? He demands an exclusive worship relationship and love. That's the very nature, character, and stuff of God. And so when we read here, friends, twice it says, King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women. And then the end of verse 2, nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. To understand the seriousness of this, what was happening in the heart of the same person, Solomon, between the opening chapters and what is recorded here? What's happening? In 1 Kings 1, in 1 Kings 3, it says this of Solomon. In 1 Kings 3, it says that, 1 Kings 3, chapter 3, Solomon showed what? Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statute of his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burnt offerings on the high places. And so there has been a massive movement in the same person and the same heart. He had gone from loving God to loving foreign women whom God prohibited. That is the seriousness. A subtle but substantial shift had taken place in his heart. And from this point onwards, I give you various quotes to look at. Quote number one, who we are in one season of life is no guarantee of who we will be in another season. And so he had gone from loving Yahweh in chapter 3 to loving foreign women in chapter 11. And the lesson being pounded home is a very important one. Who we are in one season of life is no guarantee of who we will be. And just because, how does this work out in application? Just because we were faithful in the Boys' Brigade and Girls' Brigade 20 years ago, 30 years ago, doesn't mean we are still faithful now. Doesn't mean just because we blossom in the youth fellowship 10 years ago, doesn't mean I'm walking and blossoming in my walk with God. Just because I grew a lot in my Varsity Christian Fellowship, doesn't mean I'm growing now. Just because I was spiritually high from the conference 3 months ago, 6 months ago, just because I was discipled by a great mentor one-to-one 3 years ago, just because I serve as a DG leader, discipleship group leader, small group leader, as a deacon, as an elder, as a pastor, is no guarantee that I'm walking right with God today. We do not live on past credit, friends. There are no past credits in our spiritual bank accounts. Who we are in one season of life is no guarantee of who will be in the next. Warning number two, quote number two. The little compromises of our heart will give way to the big compromise. And so he journeys from 1 Kings 3 to 1 Kings 11. Same person, same heart. Same person, same heart. But it gone from love for God to love for foreign women. Nothing ever happens. How many times have you heard of this, right? All of a sudden, overnight, he left our group, you know. All of a sudden, he left the ministry. All of a sudden, he left the church. All of a sudden, he left his wife. All of a sudden, she walked out on her husband. All of a sudden, they left the family, the kids. We are all so shocked. The lesson, friends, is nothing ever happens overnight. There is no such thing. And the warning here again and again is that it happens over a period of time. It has been brewing. It has been percolating in our hearts. Told this story many times. I was in sabbatical in Australia. We were having dinner with one or two good pastor friends. He had a phone call. He got up, went away, and he came back. I could see on his face he was different. He had just heard on the news and then got a phone call that the police had just busted a very huge pedophile ring. And one of the people who was arrested as part of the pedophile ring was a 60, 70-year-old pastor. Who was his mentor when he was a young man? How on earth did that happen? I've shared this with you. One night, this old pastor sitting in his room, working on something, he wondered to himself, I wonder what it looks like. Did he have an inclination in this area? He just clicked, and he never stopped clicking. And he was found with hundreds and hundreds of these demeaning tapes and CDs. There's no such thing, friends, as overnight. Somebody was just telling me they went to this good evangelical church in the UK that they often visit in this city whenever they go. They walked in that morning, an elder of the church, a leader of the church, got up and made an announcement. We're sorry to announce the resignation of pastor because he's about to divorce his wife. Nothing ever happens overnight. That thought has been brewing and percolating in our hearts. Warning number three. Be ruthless about our vulnerabilities. Be ruthless about our vulnerabilities. Everybody has a chink in the armor. Everyone has an Achilles heel. The warning in 1 Kings chapter 3 verse 3 is that, but he worshipped in the high places. There was already a warning that he was good in so many areas, but there was a chink in his armor. So we must watch out for our vulnerabilities. The trouble and problem with the problem of the heart is this. Look here. What's the trouble and problem with the heart? I keep doing this, right? You just can't see it. It's invisible to you, friends. With everything else, right, that happens, you see, if you are coming down with chicken pox, I can see it. I can turn to a child and say, hey, this looks like more than your normal pimples. anything that's happening outside, we can see it, we can warn you, we can help you, we can judge you and judge each other. But with things of the heart, the problem and trouble with the heart is that it is invisible. You have all the time in the world in that invisible heart to do what? To caress, to cuddle, to harbor any and all sinful thoughts. It's all happening here, friends. You have all the time to caress and cuddle and harbor. And above all, you have all the time to caress, cuddle, harbor, and somewhere along the line, to rationalize, to justify. Somebody came to our midst, had a good chat with me. Before I left, held on to my palm and said, "Brother, do me a favor. Watch out for him, somebody in our church. I can still see he's vulnerable." I couldn't quite tell. He suffers the same problem. He's still vulnerable. Watch out for him. I can tell. The obvious things are, you're talking about addictions, right? Drink addiction, drug addiction, the popping of pills, the wine woman's song. But we're also talking about the not so obvious. The things that we cuddle in our hearts. The things that we caress. Our pride, our ego, our anger when we do not get our pride and our ego satisfied. The unforgiveness, the bitterness, the worries. So watch out for our vulnerabilities. Everybody has a chink in the armor. Everybody has an Achilles heel. And so how it might work out is this. You already find that, from a man's perspective, you already find a girl really attractive in the office. No use denying it, friends. Confess it to God. And if need be, confess it to a brother in Christ. If need be, you may have to confess it to your spouse. You already find, and you know, when somebody finds you attractive in return, when they reciprocate that, it's really good for your ego, don't you think? She finds me attractive. I still have it in me, you know. Just one move on my body, one inflection on my voice, and she melts. You could do it the reverse, you know, for a lady. I still have it in me. Sometimes you hear when couples fall out, right? One has cheated on the other. Who does he think he is? He can go out and do it. I can do it too, you know. I'm still attractive. Two wrongs don't make a right, friends. Two wrongs do not make a right. You still have it in you to flirt. That's the problem. A bruised ego, bruised pride. You cuddle it, you caress it, and soon along the line, you will rationalize it. Oh, to heck with it. He can have it, I can have it. She can have it, I can do it. And what is the end result of all this that's happening in the same person, in the same heart? Verse 9. The Lord became angry with Solomon because, tell me, his heart had turned away from the Lord. The God of Israel had appeared to him twice. Now, here's a very important lesson, right? Many of us say to him, if God appeared to me just once, I'll never sin against him. In some circles, they say to you, just get the appearance of God and you never sin again. Solomon got it twice. An appearance of God to him. And he still went on and did this big time. Big time over a long, long time. And so, the end result of Solomon's drifting heart, hardening heart, and sinning heart is God was angry at him. And friends, when you go and explore this, God's anger is not so much about the sin of immorality or the sin of adultery. This is what, in the words of one writer, say, this is second level sin. You know, in the Ten Commandments, this is always with a Jewish background, an Israelite background. The Ten Commandments, two parts. The first four, in regards to their vertical relationship with God. The next six, in regard to their vertical relationship with others, humanly. Because of your vertical relationship with God, you should behave this way. What's happening here is not simply the sin of immorality, the sin of adultery. This is not second level sin, second commandment stuff. This is first commandment stuff. Exodus chapter 20. If it's not there, allow me to read that for you. In Exodus chapter 20, it just says this: "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." That is the first commandment. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. In knowing me as the true God, the unique and distinctive God, it is worship of me and love of me. Next quote. Here are the twin demons. The twin demons are apostasy, a betrayal of God, and idolatry, allegiance to other gods. And there are two sides of the same coin. King Solomon suffered both. Betrayal of God and idolatry, the running after other gods. If that is true, friends, these are the twin demons that Israel had to deal with, and all of us have to deal with, apostasy and idolatry. Then our problem is not simply, next slide, our problem is not simply half-hearted commitment to God, but full-hearted commitment to idolatry. That is what God warned Israel as she entered the promised land. The problem is that you be fully committed to yourself, the pleasing of yourself. Our problem is not simplistically a half-hearted commitment to God. Usually we think, yeah, it's like that, it's like that. Why? It's because I'm fully committed to self. That's why I'm half committed about God. And it's always about what's happening on the inside. In the words of David Wong in the Good Friday service, the mother of all battles is the moral battle of our hearts. The mother of all battles is the moral battle of our hearts. Right? Notice how it shifted. You know, 1 Kings 10, it was wisdom that God gave Solomon. It was riches that God blessed Solomon with. It was prosperity. It was peace that God blessed Solomon and Israel with. It was all about God. By chapter 11, he had made it all about him. How did he have the gumption, the temerity, the bad and foolish courage to turn it from all about God to all about me? How dare we make life all about me? We are not the center of the universe. I've given this illustration many times. You do not go to watch a concert, right, of anybody. And then you watch Pavarotti, for those who love classical music, right? And then you watch, give me a modern day band. I wouldn't say watch Lady Gaga. You know, whether you go for classical music to pop music today, you do not go to a concert and you watch the concert and you say, this concert is about me. How many of you do that regularly? You have a problem, you know. It's called delusion. 5,000 people paid tickets to applaud the guy on stage. Sin is like that. Somewhere along the line, we turn it around and say, life is about me. Where on earth did you get the gumption, the temerity, the bad courage, and the foolish courage to turn life around to be about you and me? That's what happened to Solomon. He took his eye and his heart off God, and slowly but surely, he turned from being God-hearted to self, from God-centered to self-centered, from big-minded and good-hearted to destructive and sinful. And how does it all end? When you read the rest of the chapter, chapter 11, God says, "I will snatch the kingdom from you, but I will do it in your descendants' lifetime." God will break up the kingdom into two. 10 nations, Israel to the north, 2 nations, Judah to the south. And the beginning of that breakup, God raises 3 enemies, Hadad, Rezon, Jeroboam. It will be the third fellow, Jeroboam, who will lead to the divided kingdom. But notice how it ends in Solomon's life. 1 Kings 11, verse 39. 1 Kings 11, verse 39. "I will humble David's descendants because of this, but not forever." Those 3 words gives you a glimpse of hope that sin and punishment for sin will not be the last word in the affairs of Israel. It will be God and his salvation purposes. And so by the time we read this unfolding story, we meet Jesus, and Jesus is King Jesus. He's the one who lived his life in total obedience to God. He's the one who loved God with all his heart, and whatever it cost him, he would do. From his baptism, when it says, do this to fulfill all righteousness in obedience to God. To Gethsemane, where he struggled, Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me, but not my will be done, but your will. We are looking at glimpses of the King, the true King, ushering not a temporary kingdom, but the permanent kingdom of God. But friends, by the time you come to the New Testament, you're not just witnessing the King. So I ask in closing the way we started, how many of us watched the wedding between William and Kate? I ask, how many of us witnessed the wedding between Christ and his church? When we witness the wedding between Christ and his church, there's an assessment, a criteria of the King. He lived in total obedience to God. His whole heart and life was yielded to God. We must also assess and measure the King's subjects. And the King's subjects, there's a measure here. Mark chapter 7. Is Mark chapter 7 there? Mark 7, verse 20 to 23. Mark chapter 7. Jesus went on. What comes of a person is what defiles him. For it's from within, out of a person's heart, the evil thoughts that come, the sexual immorality, the theft, the murder, the adultery, the greed, the malice, the deceit, the lewdness, the envy, the slander, the arrogance, the folly. All these evils come from inside and defile a person. King Jesus' subjects are always people who have to deal with the heart. And so in that song, it says, our hearts are prone to wander, prone to leave the one I love, prone to sin. Now that we live not under King Solomon, but King Jesus, we are to take greater warning of what's happening to our hearts. So you're the same person with the same heart. So what's happening to your hearts? Youth in our midst. Are you hanging out with the wrong people in the virtual world, I mean? And then in the real world? Whatever happened to that thankful and grateful, obedient child who is now grown out to be a thankless and ungrateful teenager? Whatever happened to your heart? Maybe you're hanging around with the wrong crowds, especially in cyberspace. Or you could be an adult. Whatever happened to that 24/7 worshiper? When you were in uni, you were so on fire. Now, first thing in the morning, rush to the office. Last thing at night, you come back, 11 o'clock, still the office, still the office. You sleep, still the office, still the office. You wake up, office, work, office, work. You're now a 24/7 worker, workaholic. Whatever happened to you as the 24/7 worshiper? Somewhere along the line, you've got to be intentional about this. This work is consuming you. This work is killing you. It's killing your walk with God. It's killing your walk with your wife, your walk with your children. It's just killing you full time. Or you could be a married couple. Whatever happened to the deep love we had between us? We've had some bad quarrels over the years. And now because of bad quarrels, we are now basically bought up, you know. She wants to do whatever she wants to do. So you move from deep love to indifference. Same person, same heart. 5 years later, 10 years later, you are unrecognizable to God. You are unrecognizable even to yourself. You are unrecognizable to your Christian friends. And don't forget, friends, this warning is given of Solomon. And it says that Solomon, in his old days, he just followed his wives. It's a warning about old age. See, old age in a country like Singapore is quite paradoxical. On the one hand, in our old age and retirement years, we are almost financially secure. Do you know that? You don't know that? The banks know that. The insurance companies know that. They want to sell you things that you don't need. So forget that yacht. You're financially secure, but in every other way, you're insecure. Everything you experience with great with great enjoyment, you now, it's the rate of return is just going down. And sometimes in a moment of weakness, you just lose it all. I've told you, I went to a funeral and this old man inched up to me on the seat and started talking to me, and then finally had enough courage to ask me the question, "Pastor Chris, can I divorce my wife?" I look at him, say, "Uncle, how old are you?" 70 over. "Why you want to divorce your wife, 70 over? That's the point. I've been unhappy with her all this time. At least 1 or 2 years of happiness, okay lah." I'm trying to persuade him, calm him down, you know. Uncle, you lasted so long, just carry on lah. Something along those lines lah. But you know, people think the flip side, you know. When you're old, losing it, losing your marbles is a very high propensity. So whether you are now an ungrateful youth, or whether now you are a mindless, aged retiree, it's all about the heart. There's one final thing I'll leave with you. The resurrected Jesus met Peter on the shores of that lake. And as he walked with Peter, maybe turning to him eyeball to eyeball, I'm eyeballing Edmund now, then I eyeball Elder Kailu, eyeball to eyeball, Jesus would have asked Peter, "Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me?" If my wife asked me, "Do you love me?" I only have to say it once. If I have to repeat it, either she didn't hear it or she thinks I didn't mean it. Jesus asked eyeball to eyeball, heart to heart with Peter, "Do you love me?" Have you seen the wedding between Christ and his people? Watch what's happening in your heart. And finally, do you love him? You could come to a church building. You could be a churchgoer. You could do ministry, but have no love for God and the Lord Jesus Christ. On Friday, hundreds of people walked into Westminster Abbey to witness a Christianized wedding. Many of the guests would not be believers of the Lord Jesus. That's not a wedding between Christ and the church. It included many other celebrities who are overtly anti-God in their lives. We mustn't allow that to happen here in our midst. You could still be a churchgoer, but you have no more love and awe and fear of God and the Lord Jesus Christ. Have you witnessed the marriage between Christ and his people? God is assessing our hearts. Let's pray.